Oh, I'll actually hand it over to Carla.
Good morning, ASAP members. You will recall that in December, we discussed transactions that affect NCI. We have also discussed the topic with the board. The session was educational and no decisions were made. At this meeting, we would like to discuss transaction between wholly owned entities, including those undertaken in preparation of an IPO and those that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity. We will report your input to the board at a future meeting. And as a final note, we also discuss all these topics at the March meeting of the Capital Markets Advisory Committee, and CMAC members were broadly supportive of the staff's observations. Now, let me go to Agenda Paper 8A. I'm going to skip slides 5 to 17 that provide a recap on the project, including transactions that affect NCI, and slides 18 to 21 that discusses information needs of lenders and other creditors that Simone will cover shortly. I will walk you through our thinking on prospective equity investors in an IPO, starting at slide 23. So on slide 23, we see three different group structures. In all scenarios, businesses A and B are controlled and wholly owned by parent B. In scenario one, businesses A and B are contained within a single legal entity. In scenario two, businesses A and B are separate legal entities held by an intermediary entity, a holding company. In scenario three, businesses A and B are separate legal entities directly owned by company P. We would like to highlight that even though the legal structure is different, the substance of the group is the same in all scenarios. Moving on to slide 24, suppose the parent decides to sell businesses A and B together in an IPO. In scenario one, businesses A and B can be sold together as they are already contained in a single legal entity. In scenario two, the businesses can be sold by selling the holding company. In scenario three, the parent will first need to undertake a legal restructuring. The parent could do the restructuring in a number of ways, as shown on slide 25. The parent can merge A and B into a single legal entity, or the parent can create a separate new co that holds A and B. Or it could get A to acquire B, or the other way around. Moving to slide 26, we noted that in all these scenarios, the economic substance remains the same. Businesses A and B are being sold to new investors. In particular, you may observe that scenario 3.1 is largely identical to scenario 1. Scenario 3.2 is largely identical to scenario 2. And therefore, we think the information provided should also be largely the same, regardless of the legal form of the transaction. In scenarios 1 and 2, the prospective investors will receive historical information about business A and B. Accordingly, we think that historical information about business A and B should also be provided in all sub-scenarios of scenario 3. With that, I'd like to draw your attention to question 1. And ask whether you agree with our conclusion on slide 26 that the predecessor approach would provide useful information to prospective equity investors about BCUCC between wholly owned entities undertaken in preparation of an IPO.
Anthony, my answer to the question is it depends. I mean, it depends on what we mean by predecessor method, because if you go around the globe, that term is used for different approaches. So if by predecessor method you mean one where you also alter comparatives and make them look like they've always been combined on a historical cost basis, you might get something like similar information for the others. If it's a predecessor method, as in some countries where it's just prospective, then you're not going to get the same. So you know, I realise the examination of what predecessor method, if any, is for the future, but it is actually critical to the analysis you're trying to make here. Also, I'd say it depends. You know, I think this comparison you're making with the restructuring scenario 3 and scenarios 1 and 2, well, it would all depend on the history of 1 and 2 and how they were acquired and when they were acquired. And so you know, I'm not sure it's as powerful a tool to reach a conclusion as you were trying to use it. Having said that, I do think often the predecessor method is useful in these situations. At least that's certainly the whilst not performing sort of formal outreach, certainly that's the anecdotal evidence I've received talking to investors, is that historical trend would be something that was useful for them. Again, it presupposes you are changing the comparatives, but that rather than an artificial valuation at this date, immediately ahead of a transaction. You know, if anything, that's likely to confuse, is as investors put it, and actually they would wish to ignore that and look to see what actually happened in the third-party transaction or the IPO, as this comes out. That's when there's a set of valuations imminent. It's not useful to prejudge that with setting up a whole lot of valuation processes directly ahead of the IPO. So I think the historic information is probably more useful to inform the valuations that would be made by those transacting parties as part of the IPO. I don't think. I thought the analysis you used on the credit analysts and debt providers was probably more powerful in terms of looking at what users want, rather than this one of saying, well, we're going to get the same information if we do it this way, and so we should compare these three scenarios. But I would agree with the conclusion, not necessarily the process.
Thank you. First, we support the scope of the discussions for this SF meeting, which deals with BCUCCs between wholly owned entities. We think that the accounting for BCUCCs should not depend solely on whether there are any CIs that are affected by the transaction. And moreover, we are not fully convinced that different approaches should be applied based on the composition of primary users as of the date of the transaction. So primary users, as defined in the conceptual framework, include potential users, so that is potential investors, lenders, and other creditors. And accordingly, we think the composition of primary users would not be significantly changed. And regarding the BCUCCs between wholly owned entities in preparation for IPOs, we are not aware of any views that go against the ISB staff's analysis and that the predecessor approach should be applied for the scenarios presented in slide 26 of the agenda paper 8A. And can we also add the views on the analysis on debt investors and credit analysts later?
Okay. Similar to the comments, Nami's comments, I would like to make more fundamental comments regarding the issue of primary users. The ISB staff differentiate between information needs of equity investors and those of debt investors. In one sense, I am in sympathy with the reasoning that there are distinctive information needs for different types of users. Having said that, the distinctions in information needs between equity investors and debt investors are only a matter of a degree, I think. And the information provided in accordance with IFRS should meet those distinctive information needs on a common ground. Therefore, I don't think such distinctions would carry any particular meaning that applies exclusively to BCUCC information. In broader sense, as far as I understand, IFRS does not require equity investors and debt investors to be differentiated when it comes to the preparation of general purpose financial statements, but requires common information needs across different types of users to be met. And regarding the issue of the timing, I don't think financial information at a certain point in time is used exclusively by the users who have interest in the company at the very same point in time. Rather, I would assume that the financial information at a certain point in time would continue to be used as a basis for trend analysis and projection covering the entire periods, as long as the company exists on the premise of going concern. Therefore, it is not reasonable, I think, to consider as the key factor the existence of NCIs or perspectives of only few types of users as of a certain point in time when determining accounting methods. Yeah, thank you.
Alexander?
Sorry, very pedestrian question here, okay? Very, very basic. When you mean parent P controls and wholly owns, you mean 100% of all shares?
Yes.
Absolutely. No minority interest at all whatsoever on preference shares or anything like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so the my jurisdiction, they favor the predecessor method in that specific purpose.
Yu Chen?
Thank you. First of all, we appreciate what the ISP staff did in the past several months. Regarding the question in the agenda paper, we agree with that the prospective equity investors require historical information for trend analysis. And therefore, we support the use of the predecessor method for IPO cases. This is also consistent with the current accounting requirement in China. And what's more, we also think that the accounting method for BCUCC undertaken for IPO cases and those that affect NCI in the receiving entity should be the same, should be consistent with each other, because in our opinion, the commercial substance for both types of BCUCC is the same. So that means whatever, whether the receiving entity becomes a listed company or not in the future, the accounting method for BCUCC should be the same. When talking about the commercial substance, in our opinion, the predecessor method could reflect the substance of this kind of transaction, because the common control means that the company only changes its legal form before and after the acquisition, and the ownership of assets and the equity has not changed. Many of the BCUCC transactions take place within a group. In our opinion, the purpose of this kind of acquisition is only to reorganize resources in order to better manage the business and for sustainable operation. So to sum up, the BCUCC is just a kind of group restructuring. Therefore, the value revaluation is not necessary. So that's the our views on the commercial substance. Besides, in addition to that, we think the predecessor method is better for BCUCC accounting, at least for the following reasons. First, just as I mentioned, BCUCC is a kind of group restructuring. Second, predecessor method will provide less incentive to for management to manipulate accounting for BCUCC transaction. Third, fair value is very difficult to estimate, especially for long-term assets without active market. Four, goodwill accounting under the acquisition method is very difficult and is really a huge problem, especially in China. Just as I mentioned in the previous meeting. So in our opinion, the predecessor method is appropriate and better for the BCUCC transaction. Lastly, I would like to share a preliminary survey made in the second half of last year. The Chinese accounting standards require the BCUCC to be accounted for using the predecessor method since 2007. From 2007 to 2017, over 2,100 listed companies have BCUCC transactions, and they used the predecessor method. Based on our observation, the predecessor method was implemented very well in these companies, and we didn't hear the investors complain they need more information regarding this UCC. And during this survey, we also ask the question about what kind of accounting method we prefer. More than 50% respondents said that they prefer the predecessor method, and around 73% respondents said that the commercial substance of BCUCC is different from the substance of the the business combination under not common control. So that's what we observed during this survey. So finally, our suggestion is to use predecessor method for all kind of BCUCC transactions as the single accounting method. That's all.
Christina.
Thank you. From AOSSG, we received responses from Australia, China, Hong Kong, Indonesia, Japan, Korea, New Zealand, Pakistan, Singapore, and Thailand. And I think in general, it was quite easy for us to conclude that in a wholly owned situation where BCUCC takes place, the predecessor method is a sensible approach because the only primary user you have is the controlling party. But the debate started when we turned it into an IPO situation where you are wholly owned and then you're now preparing for it to go for listing. Because I think at least for Australia, Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore, Pakistan, and New Zealand, we think that we wonder what is the information change, that how does the information needs change from a prospective equity investor and an existing equity investor. So we were actually interested to hear what your recent CMAC discussions, what the outcomes were. In AOSSG, we also heard from investors and equity analysts from Australia, Hong Kong, and Korea. And in an IPO, most of them have said that in an IPO situation, they agree historical values or the predecessor method would provide the information they need for trend analysis. But the majority of them also say that the fair value information also gives them the useful information on the prospects of the business, of the listing business combined. So, you know, I think that's what we are, the additional bits that we are hearing from the investors from some of these jurisdictions. But yeah, I think China and Korea and Japan have already mentioned, so I won't go through their comments. The other things that were mentioned by the group were, I think the slide 26 talks about, I think covers also some of the points that we weren't sure how the staff actually got to the end where, you know, to the conclusion where the predecessor value actually would be a clear answer. I guess there will be some positives and negatives, pros and cons of using the predecessor value in this IPO situation. But yeah, that's where the group basically got to.
Could I ask you a clarification, Christina? When you said that some of the users you spoke to wanted the fair value information, was that for the fair value information just for the acquiree or was it for the entire group?
I have to say that some of the investors have said it would be better to have the fair value information of the listing businesses combined, so acquirer and acquiree. But that's just some investors who mentioned that.
So the ones who just wanted it for the acquiree, were they at all bothered that, depending on how it was structured, you'd get fair value information for different parts of the group?
Yes. Yeah. And I have to also mention that a lot of these sophisticated investors are already doing their own valuations on the combined business. But, you know, obviously that's a small percentage of the market. A lot of individual investors or smaller institutional investors aren't able to do
that. Yes?
Just one more clarifying question, building on what Peter just asked. So those investors who ask for fair value information, do they want fair value information of identifiable assets and liabilities, or do they want fair value of the business, which is slightly different information?
Yeah, we didn't quite cover it in that detail, but the one thing they did mention is even if you were to provide fair value, it doesn't need to be at a granular level. So, you know, I think it's... I don't think it needs to be as detailed as, you know, what we are imagining in terms of what we do now in IFRS 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. With reference to business combination under condo control between wholly owned entities, we agree with the staff view that the use of predecessor accounting is providing useful information.
Okay. Leonardo.
Thank you. We strongly support the project. We think that the staff proposal summarized in slide 27 of the paper go in the right direction. In our view, the predecessor method should be the starting point for transactions that do not affect non-controlling interest. And we also think that another factor that may be considered is whether the transaction is paid in cash or by shares. Because in our view, this can be important for the lenders and other creditors of the receiving entity. Thank you.
Linda?
Just general agreement with where the staff has landed makes sense. I would also agree with Andrew that you actually have to define what the predecessor method means so that there's clarity there, including the provision of comparative. So the users that we talked to agreed with the conclusions that you had based in the paper. The one caveat that we got was, and I think you're already thinking about it, but with the notion is there is a difference between a very, very small NCI and a very substantive NCI, and how you deal with those circumstances should be the subject of some further discussions, but general agreement and support for where you've landed.
Jin Chao?
I think, yes. Just two clarifications. One is to Yuchen's comments. Yuchen said that in the past about 10 years, there are 2,100 listed Chinese companies involving BCUCC transactions. And those companies apply predecessor method. And it seems that investors have no additional demand information needs based on the predecessor method information. My question is that what kind of information is simply based on the predecessor based information, or provided that also fair value information, you know, disclosed in the notes, such as the fair value of the assets and liability of the acquired business also disclosed, and also the expected synergies of the BCUCC transaction also disclosed. So the investors are happy with those, you know, disclosed information, not purely possess accounting treatment on the balance sheet and also those fair value information disclosed in notes. So this is the first clarification to Yuten. And the second, the clarification to Nami. Nami said that it seemed to me you support one single accounting treatment for BCUCC, regardless there is whether those BCUCC involving NCI or not, regardless the composition of the primary users. So my question is that what single accounting treatment you support, predecessor method or current value method? Maybe,
Thank you, Zhang Qiao. That's what I was missing. Actually, we agree that the disclosure of fair value information in the notes, in addition to the predecessor method for the BCUCC transaction.
Thank you for the clarification. First, we haven't made our firm view regarding the single approach is the best scenario for all BCUCC transactions. So my point of view is that the composition of the users should not be significantly affected to the transaction. And for wholly owned entities scenarios, predecessor approach may be a good starting point to consider, as Leonardo also mentioned.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would like just make a couple of clarifications about the staff's approach before we move to lenders and creditors, given sort of we had a few consistent comments around we shouldn't just be focusing on primary users as the basis for determining which method should be applied. And what I would like to clarify is that we're not solely focusing on primary users. I suppose it's fair to say that our starting point is in the analysis, is that current value information would be useful, which is consistent with the accounting treatment in IFRS 3. And then the next question that we need to ask is, okay, so the logic is that to the extent that business combinations under common control are similar to regular business combinations, same accounting method should be applied. To the extent they are or can be different, then a different method or some modifications need to be applied. Now, that consideration is further overlaid with considerations around composition of primary users, because when we're trying to satisfy common information needs, those common information needs may be different depending on composition of primary users. So if I have a controlling party and I don't have any NCI, of course, my common information needs are different compared to a situation when I have significant NCI. And secondly, sort of the consideration around are transactions similar, what are information needs, all that needs to be overlaid with the consideration of the cost constraint. And we actually posted a paper for the board last week that describes our overall approach, so you can find more information there. And the second sort of comment I wanted to make is around the substance of the transactions. And I think our staff view is that from the point of view of the controlling party, of course, a business combination under common control can be a mere restructuring where they're trying to optimize the structure of the group. But from the point of view of the receiving entity and of the users of information of that receiving entity, of course, the transaction is different. Before the transaction, the receiving entity does not own any business. After the transaction, it does. And again, so this sort of staff analysis is reflected in the papers that were posted for the board last week, if you would like to see more detail. And I think with that, I would like to move to the second.
Thank you, Yulia, and good morning, ASAF members. Agenda paper 8B explores the information needs of existing and potential lenders and other creditors and discusses the implication of that analysis for accounting for BCUCC. The staff identified three characteristics in which claims held by lenders and other creditors are typically different from equity claims. These are covered in paragraph 11 to 14. These characteristics influence both the information required for credit analysis and the way the information is used. Lenders and other creditors are exposed to credit risk of their debt investment, and they use information in general purpose financial statements to assess entities' ability to service the existing debt and to raise new debt. Our research and outreach show that core prediction models used for credit analysis tend to display a predominance of cash flow analysis, as described in paragraph 18 to 24, and the focus on the total gross debt, including our recognized commitments and contingent liabilities, as described in paragraph 25 to 28. We acknowledge that debt investors and credit analysts also consider valuation, profitability ratios, and ratios based on the statement of financial position, in particular debt-to-equity ratios. But those considerations are secondary in their analysis and tend to have a limited impact on the outcome of that analysis. We also note that debt investors and credit analysts will be interested at the time of the transaction whether the exchange amount is fair. As Julia Carlo noted before, CMAC members agreed with that analysis. Staff observations are summarized in paragraph 29 to 31, and based on how debt investors and credit analysts process information, the staff think that the result of those users' analysis on the ability of an entity to service and raise debt would not depend greatly on whether a current value approach or a form of predecessor value approach is applied to account for BCUCC. The staff, therefore, think that the board could pursue different approaches for BCUCC that affect NCI in the receiving entity and those that affect lenders and creditors in the receiving entity. In particular, a current value approach for all or some transactions that affect NCI in the receiving entity and a different approach, such as a form of predecessor approach for transactions that affect lenders and other creditors in the receiving entity but do not affect NCI. And moving on our second question, do you agree with our observations?
Jim? So I agreed on the first topic, why didn't that, wasn't really additive to the discussion, but on the second topic, I do think there could be a basis to me, maybe this, so the question was all or some. I would probably start with some transactions involving NCI. For example, very small amounts of NCI might lead me to believe that the accounting could look more like the predecessor basis, describe however you will what that exactly means. The larger the amount of NCI, the more the transaction may seem in substance, you know, so if you had a 49% acquisition, maybe that feels more like a transaction that involves 51% acquisition. Where you draw that line exactly, I don't know. But I think if you can conclude that on a go-forward basis, business combination under common control, I can't say the initials, involving no NCI, and a predecessor basis is still useful to investors on a go-forward basis, so that is investors in the IPO, then seemingly any set of equity investors would be able to use that same set of financial statements for their purposes, including if there were small amounts of NCI. That is, why would an investor who invests tomorrow be able to make assessments, but an NCI holder who had an investment yesterday and makes a buy, hold, or sell decision tomorrow would need a different set of financial information is a little bit confusing to me. So to me, it feels like, am I more like one versus am I more like the other? But not helpful at all in deciding where that line is.
Nami?
So we do not agree with the IS staff's analysis. For example, we question whether credit analysis doesn't tend to focus on the statement of financial position, as indicated in slide 21 of agenda paper 8A, is an accurate statement. And nevertheless, we share view that the needs of lenders and other creditors for the information based on the current value approach may not be as significant compared to equity shareholders. And considering the cost that would be incurred by requiring the current value approach for BCUCCs. So we support the conclusion that the predecessor method should be used for BCUCCs between wholly owned entities that affect lenders and other creditors.
ASSG members agree with the conclusions that the staff arrived in the paper.
Yeah, the benefit of a predecessor accounting approach is the continuity of the cash flows. So this seems to be consistent with the nature of internal reorganization of the BCECC. So the predecessor method is commonly used. This means that it provides useful information. However, to the extent that credit analysts look at other information than simply cash flows, like, for example, debt-to-equity ratios, current value also can provide useful information. So they're both useful.
My comments on the first section was actually predicated on what you just said, Yula, that there is cost-benefit analysis necessary here to compare to a current valuation approach, that we are looking for to work out a boundary of where we would have an exception to a current value approach. I thought the analysis done here on the needs of debt investors and credit analysts showed that the balance of where the benefits from the costs of producing current valuation approach are going to be different. And indeed, the many of the costs will not lead to the kind of benefits you would get for an equity investor. So I thought it was a very worthwhile analysis. I thought it was quite convincing. And my only thoughts were, going back to the first part, something that looked in the same way as the precise needs of users in the situation of an IPO might actually make that argument more powerful too.
I'll just very quickly say, we would also agree that some more analysis in the IPO case, to the extent of the lenders creditors one, would also be useful, and it will be very strong. It will be much stronger.
Yu Chen.
Okay, thank you. For question A, we generally agree with the staff's point that the debit investors and credit analysts, their analysis will not depend greatly on whether a current value approach or predecessor approach is applied. And we agree that the credit analysis mainly focus on cash flows. But for question B, the paper suggested two different kinds of approach, just as I respond to the question one, that we suggest predecessor method as the single accounting method for all kind of BCUCC, because we think all this kind of BCUCC has the same commercial substance. If we allowed two different kind of accounting method, that would hurt the comparability of the information, and it would create some structuring opportunities for entity to achieve their desired accounting outcome. That's it.
Alexander.
In the jurisdictions that I represent pretty much favor this approach. So some sort of predecessor method, some sort of, because it's we agree that it must be clearly stated what the predecessor method means. I agree there are different meanings. And a current fair value approach for the other transactions that have an ECI component. And just to give you another element here, I know that we are not discussing equity investors here, but those transactions that are discussing option A and B here will affect equity investors in this in the IPO context. Imagine the situation that I saw before. So I'm an equity investor that are buying this company after the IPO. So pretty much if this company has NCI, going to use predecessor, does not have NCI, going to use a predecessor method. If it has NCI, going to use a fair value method. It's very hard to argue that the shareholder structure of that company affect the information that an investor needs.
Yeah.
So if I'm buying a share of a company after the IPO, I don't know if I care if this company had an NCI before or not. So it's very hard to argue that the kind of information that I as an investor in this IPO demand would change if the company has an NCI or not. So I think that most people favor this approach, this difference. But from a theoretical point of view, that has any difference. I don't know if I'm making myself clear here.
Yes, you are, and we will definitely be bringing more analysis on sort of whether existing NCI as opposed to prospective equity investors are in slightly different positions and why and how the information needs interact and whether they can be sort of
from an evaluation perspective. Old school accounting valuation perspective, that makes a lot of sense. But from an information perspective, I don't know if that makes sense. So why investor would prefer different information depending on the shareholder structure before the IPO? Should be the same. So if fair value is important, so if goodwill, for example, is important for an investor, it should be important having an NCI of 2%, 3%. I don't know how we're going to the threshold be. So from a theoretical point of view here, it's difficult to
we'll come back on that.
To establish the different things. You should give some thought of that.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you. I think the problem of the suggested current value approach lies where it requires an accounting treatment partially similar to the acquisition method like other PC non-UCC in IFRS 3. By recognizing fair value of the identifiable assets only, but very much different from IFRS 3 by deeming transaction as acquisition of individual assets or a group of assets rather than a business unit by ignoring recognition of goodwill.
Okay.
When it comes to business combination, current value information should contain the fair value of the acquired business unit in its entirety, which is the trading unit of BCC transactions. So that is, I cannot agree with the staff analysis, which claims that the current value approach, which includes the fair value information of only identifiable assets without the fair value information of business unit in its entirety, provides the most useful information. So, actually, taking account of the fundamental differences between arm's length transactions and within the group transactions, the acquisition method in IFRS 3 may not be applicable, I think. Eventually, an alternative to the impracticable current value approach should be sought after, I believe. And one alternative maybe to modify the predecessor method, which is being applied generally in practice currently. Say a modified predecessor method could use as the proxy measures of the current value, the existing current carrying values of the parent, which are based on the objective and the actual transaction price and goodwill that arose by the most recent arm's length transaction of the business unit. This seems to be the second best measure that can be applied, considering the practical difficulties in determining the fair value of a business unit. Finally, regarding the issue of, I'd like to add another issue. I think it's critical. Regarding the issue of identifying the acquiring or receiving entity, in many cases involving BCUCC, it may be very difficult or lack substance to identify the substantial acquirer because the parent could arbitrarily structure the BC transaction, including deciding which subsidiary will be the acquirer, especially in a merger UCC, as an example. This leads to failing to reflect economic substance of the BC UCC. In those cases, I think a pooling of interest method could be explored. So it could be helpful to revisit the previous standard, say IAS 22, which addressed an accounting treatment in the case where it is difficult to identify an acquirer. Thank you.
Anne?
Yu Chen told us about a survey in China where lots of users were happy with the information they had. It was based on predecessor information, but they also had the fair value disclosure in relation to the predecessor method, but fair value disclosure. I was just wondering if any other jurisdictions have got evidence where they also have a lot of predecessor method accounting, but have fair value disclosure as a supplementary thing. So I don't know, in Italy you have lots of BC UCC, but no fair value disclosure? Okay, so I just wondered if any other jurisdictions have these fair value disclosures like China.
In AOSSG jurisdictions, it's not a requirement to provide the fair value information, but we have definitely heard from the investors in Australia, Hong Kong, and Korea that disclosures of fair value would be useful.
Okay, this brings us to the end of this discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would like to try to squeeze in...